We're going to take the scientific accuracy in one lesson. I'll give you some from out of your notes, more often than probably in the notes. This has been a very wonderful study in Christian apologetics. I have several books on the scientific accuracy of the Bible. I love very much, like Bell Dawson. These men were not dumbbells, like Harry Rimmer. They had degrees after a name, like a thermometer. Men that have been honored in every branch of science, like the some 300 scientists that are contributors to the Science Research Association and their newsletter. I have been taking that since 1963, I think, or 64, about a year after they founded it. And it was just a mimeograph copy in those days, a few pages. But they have, I read in one of the newsletters recently, they said they had over 300 correspondents that they, men high in every field. Many of them are in NASA and in the nuclear program of the United States. Many of them are have high teaching positions in many of the universities. I looked up Bell Dawson's, and his dad was also similar to him. But I have four or five books by Bell Dawson. I value them very highly. One on the science and the Bible. It's got Bernard Graham beat, because Bernard Graham doesn't believe it. But he was a very brilliant man, as well as a member of both the Scientific Association of America and of Great Britain. It is a wonderful study, and I wish I had time to devote a lot more attention to it. Harry Rimmer had a very good scientific name for a lot of wild guesses and theories. He called it guessology. He has a book that I have on harmony of science and the Bible. He's now with the Lord. I also value his book, The Magnificence of Jesus, on the life of Christ. It's very rich. But in his pamphlet on Lot's wife, page 40, he said for over 25 years, he had offered $1,000 to anyone who could prove one scientific inaccuracy in the Bible. $1,000. Only one man ever tried to collect. And it was in the Reader's Digest. The time that he did. And this ad was put in 27 different countries. For $1,000, anybody could prove. Now, it's true he got rafts of letters, and we still see all that were against idioms in the Bible, like the dew falling, or the sun rising and the sun setting. You notice in your notes we've said something about that. That is the language of appearance. The Bible is not written in scientific jargon. In New York City in 1948, William Floyd sued to collect the $1,000. And naturally, the Association for the Advancement of Atheism in America, the 4A's, paid for it. In the suit, he claimed there were 51 scientific errors in the Bible. Nobody explained why, if there were 51 errors, nobody but him ever tried to collect the $1,000. Justice Benjamin Shalek was the judge in the trial. And after they had presented their so-called 51 errors, and they were answered by Harry Rimmer, the judge laughed at the accusers and threw the case out of court. With the judgment, they had failed to prove one of them. And no one else ever tried after that. I was reading just the other day where another man made the same offer, and nobody ever tried to claim the money from him. There is no conflict between the Bible and science. Herr Rimmer said in his pamphlet on page 40, 1,900 years of advancing knowledge plus a century of modern scientific investigation have never uncovered one fact which discredits one statement in the Bible, in the quotation. Here's the man that was nobody's fool. He was also a member of the American Academy of Science and the Great Britain Academy and the Canadian. And a teacher of science. There is no conflict between the Bible and science because the same God who created all science, all nature, all knowledge, also gave the Bible. Sometime, if you want a beautiful experience, you study the 19th Psalm with the sliding from nature to revelation, to experience. They all coincide. No conflict. No contradiction. The heavens declare the glory of God. The word declare is openly shown, openly displayed. The glory of God, the firmament showed his handiwork. That's the great expanse. Day unto day out of speech and night unto night showeth knowledge. There's no place or language where their voice is not heard. And in them he has set a tabernacle for the sun, and so on. That's nature. And they all declare the glory of God. Paul says the same thing in Romans 1. The invisible things of God are clearly seen by the things that are made. Then he goes right into the Word. He says, concerning the Word, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandments of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. And the word altogether, no exceptions. There are no mistakes in the word of God. It's infallible. It's inerrant. As given in the original. You can't vouchsafe forever translation. Then he goes right into experience. Moreover, by them thy servant is warned, and in keeping of them is great reward. And then the cleansing of a man's way and prescription for sins, cure. It goes from nature to the Word, revelation, and then to Christian experience or godly experience. No conflict. Here's why you get a man genuinely converted. I don't care how great a scientist he is, philosopher, student, he finds no problem with work. And he finds no problem believing in God. Let me say it again. All unbelief is no problem of the head. The problem's in the heart. They're willingly ignorant. Jesus said, if any man will know, he shall know of the doctrine that I speak of myself or of the Father that sent me. Well, Peter said they are willingly ignorant. Keep that in mind. As in history, it is true in science. Well, the Bible was not written as a textbook on science. If it were, I would find there the most wonderful science in all the world, for God knows all the mysteries of nature, doesn't he? He made the whole shebang. He set it going, and he keeps it going. And he makes it all going toward the desired end. It's not haphazard. All science, and the very possibility of science, proves that nature had a designer, a builder, a creator. Because it isn't haphazard. It is not a result of a big bang. You see, if anybody can believe that, can believe in the tooth fairy. I'll not have any problem believing any kind of crazy stuff. Like the little green men in Ireland. No problem. Or even in Christian Science. If anybody can believe that, it has to be nuts. I'm using a vulgar expression. I can't think of a better one. At least they, as Ann Landers says, they've got geraniums in their cranium. They're probably growing a whole vegetable garden. God knows, though, all the mysteries of science. In Him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, as the Scripture says. So if the Bible wanted to talk on science, and if I find science in the Bible, it ought to be accurate science. It ought to be above man's knowledge most of the time. It's amazing how much of modern science is catching up with the science of the Bible. You should have a good book by one of these godly men. The Science Research Association now is putting out quite a few of them. These men with great ability. I love to read after them. The God of the Bible is the God over nature. He who inspired men to write built the universe. But, I mean, I warn you, as I do in your notes, I don't expect the Bible to be written, couched in the language of science or philosophy or psychology. If it were, it would be out of date before the next morning's newspaper. It is in the idiom of the people. Hence, no party has ever had any problem, I don't care how great a scientist he is, with the sun rising and setting. In fact, they said that on TV this morning. The sun will rise at a certain time. They didn't stop to say, since the earth is spinning on its axis, and it's in its certain time of spinning, it'll be so and so and so and so, and you wouldn't have time for anything else all day. It's easy to say the sun rises. So even the almanac says that. Same way with dew falling. We know it condenses upon objects. You stand out in it early in the morning, it condenses on you. Or on your car windows. The Bible is not scientifically infallible, Washington Babden says. In his book, How Much Is Left. For he says the narrative of creation is in the first chapter of Genesis, while it presents the most remarkable counterpart to the discoveries of science. He doesn't explain how come it had such a wonderful coincidence with modern science. When it was written back there, when there wasn't any real science as far as creation is concerned. He said it cannot be said to be totally, precisely to agree with the records written on the rocks. Then he says, so far at any rate as they have been read at present. Notice he's out. He can't admit that they might be reading the rocks wrongly. I don't know why any scientist on the face of the earth couldn't have taken a lesson from the moon rocks. If they brought back, when they first landed on the moon, brought back the rocks. They found rocks only a few feet apart, and they tested them by the argon rate of decay test, And there was a difference of a billion years between the two rocks, both of them lying on top of the moon. Any real honest scientist, geologist in particular, will admit that these dates that they give are completely capable of another explanation. We'll see one of them that science research gives. Morris has some good material on it in the Genesis Flood, and he also has it in several of his books. Harry Rimmer, in his Harmony of Science and the Scriptures, page 59, and I quote, "We must not forget that there are errors in scientific thought. The opinions of scientists change so rapidly that it is reported that the library of the Louvre in Paris contains 3.5 miles of bookshelves holding volumes of science that has become absolute in the last 50 years. Or obsolete. Let's excuse my English, my pronunciation. Has become obsolete in the last 50 years. 3.5 miles of bookshelves with scientific theories that were infallible when they wrote them. And they were against the Bible. And they proved the Bible wrong by them. And by the way, they got a whole bunch of them now, a whole lot more. The libraries in every school in the country, it's state owned, is full of false scientific statements made in the name of absolute truth, especially to teach evolution. In fact, he continues, the reader may recall that the famous list of 51 scientific facts published by the French Academy of Science in 1861, all of which purported to contradict some statement in the scriptures, in these 50 years, not one statement of the Bible has been changed, but all 51 of those have been corrected. Then he said, there is not one living man of science today who holds any one of those 51 scientific statements. End of quotation. In other words, you're supposed to throw out the Word of God, which has all the comfort to pillow your soul upon, especially when you're dying, for these ever-changing sibilants of science, which change with every science. They don't agree with themselves. Look at the awful flip-flop of the so-called science of how the earth began, the cosmogony, and when I was in school. I have a science book that I had when I was in junior high down in 35th 6th Street in Miami, Florida, and then over in Edison High. And it taught the Nebula Hypothesis. That all the nebulae were new stars being formed. But now they know that those nebulae are universes like ours. Like the island universe of Andromeda. Let's look at the cosmogonies of the day Moses wrote, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The best Egyptian cosmogony was by Manetho, M-A-N-N-E-T-H-O, Manetho, And maybe even Moses studied under him. He wrote when Moses wrote. He taught in the Egyptian universities. I don't know what they called them in those days. I don't know if Moses argued with him or not. Manetho wrote, the earth was a four-cornered, oblong slab of iron, and on top of that was a slab was an ocean. And then the rain came from leaks in the iron slab. They couldn't conceive of water staying where there wasn't something to hold it up. Neither could they conceive of an earth that rested on nothing. So Job wrote before Moses, probably. I believe it. And he said, he hangeth the earth upon nothing. That's good science. That's gravity. There wasn't anybody back there to believe the earth hung on nothing. It rested on something. The usual one, like the Hindus had, it rested on the back of four elephants. Those, quite some elephants. Those four elephants were on the back of four tortoises. And the tortoises swam in a great ocean. Now, of course, you have to stop somewhere. They never explained where the ocean, what it rested on. And then what that rested upon that it rested upon. Almost like the evolutionists who keep going back until they think you'll forget in the abysmal past to ask the embarrassing question, well, where did that come from? Remember we said in anthropology, they think if you go back far enough and out far enough, finally you'll lose yourself in obscurity and don't ask any more embarrassing questions. The Chaldean cosmogony, the earth was a live thing. And the feathers on that live thing were the rocks and trees. And man only remains alive on the skin. The man is living on a sleeping monster and like fleas on a dog. If you dug deep enough, you'd get through the skin and awaken the live monster and he'd shake himself and you'd be in trouble. I even was dating and engaged to marry a girl whose dad, old man Money, believed that the world was square, and said the Bible teaches it's square. I used to have fun arguing with him, until my girlfriend got after me about it. That's one that got away, by the way. I think he was just arguing because he loved to argue, and he knew I did too. The astronauts kind of messed up the theory of the flat Earth and the square Earth and it resting on anything with its picture of a ball out there in space. Funniest thing, when the astronauts landed on the moon, I was preaching in a mountain church up in North Carolina. And, they were all stirred up about the thing. They said, God wouldn't allow man to go to the moon. So that's not the moon that they went, where they went. One of them said, I'll tell you where they went. They went to that place called Mars. I wanted to say so bad, well, that's further away than the moon. But they said, God said that he gave the earth to man. He wouldn't let him go to the moon. They've kind of messed up a lot of these cosmogonies with some people. Whenever you speak of testing the Bible on page 35, on scientific grounds, even some of its friends are afraid of the test. In this testing, we need not expect the Bible to use scientific phraseology. But wherever the Bible does give any kind of scientific statement, I expect it to be either accurate to modern scientific finding or above it. Professor Dana, in your notes in the third paragraph, said, "The grand old book of God still stands, and this old earth, the more its leaves are turned over and pondered, the more it will sustain and illustrate the sacred word." Here's the amazing thing. You could read these other cosmogonies, and I have a book on ancient cosmogonies, a whole book, about 500 pages. It's amazing, all the crazy guesses that men have made through the last 6,000 years. It is utterly amazing how much science is coming back to an instant starting of creation. A miraculous instant starting by unsaved science. Look at the great flip-flop from uniformitarianism of Darwin. That was the gospel for almost 100 years. It was just about 25 years ago when the Big Bang Theory was advanced. Uniformitarianism, and of course, all the table of the geological ages is built upon Lyell's. He's the one that invented the whole thing. And without any going around the world to look at different strata, anything, he just took one strata in France and he began to build up, and he built the great geological tables of some 4 billion years. The only trouble is you could go a few miles away and the whole strata is reversed. And his billions of years were absolutely arbitrary. No evidence whatsoever. And yet, almost every college and high school textbook on geology will follow Lyell's false table of geology, the geological ages. And they're not true at all. I wish I had time to go into one of the books that comes out of the Science Research Association, where they've studied for several years the strata of the Grand Canyon. That deep cliff-like where you have all the geological ages there. In fact, the everlasting one of them. But the trouble is, on one side of the canyon, it'll go one order, and on the other side of the canyon, another order. It doesn't fit. Not only that, but they say life began, for instance, in the Cambrian Age and so on. And in one place, sure enough, there are one of the tribolites that they said were first, and they go over another place, and they find in the Cambrian same strata, they find all kinds of later animals, fossil animals, fossils of the animals. But uniformitarianism was the gospel. In other words, all things continue as they were in the fathers on the ground as well as in society. They had it. Only gradualism, and always upward, of course, in evolution. So we got here. We're the best thing a monkey ever made. But everything was contradictory to this. So lo and behold, they did a 180-degree flip-flop. Can you want anything get more different than the Big Bang Theory and the uniformitarianism? The Big Bang Theory is the whole, everything in the universe, all energy and all matter, was in an infinitesimal atom of matter. All of it. There's a lot of it. We should see in astronomy. Then all of a sudden, it all blew up. A big bang. A mammoth, inconceivable explosion that took place in a couple of 3 quadrillionths of a second. You have to have that too. And as it blew out, it all gathered back up into all the planets and all the stars and all the order and the Science Research Association shows that the very difference of movements in our planetary system absolutely refutes the Big Bang Theory. Anything like it. There's no way that these different planets and planetoids and all the rest could be going in different directions around the sun and in different planes and come from Big Bang. But how much proof have they got for the Big Bang? Nobody was there and saw it. It had been blown up. It had been part of the Big Bang. Let me quote from a professor of molecular science, Dr. Seaborg, of the University of California. He was one of the discoverers of the element californium, which is element 98. Remember, the 95 elements in the table are in nature. From there on up to 105 are man-made. Man has made brand new elements by splitting the atom. Professor Seaborg says, following Dr. Einstein, Albert Einstein, who died in 1955, so he's not too far back. Yet he was an atheist. I want to give his first, and then I want to give Seaborg's. He gave his unconditional approval to Seaborg's book, and I think wrote a foreword in it, in which he said, quotation marks from Einstein, if the universe is running down, that's entropy, and nature's processes are proceeding in just one direction, the inescapable inference is that everything had a beginning. That's Albert Einstein. Here's Seaborg's. It's even more graphic. Quotation marks. Somehow and sometime, the cosmic processes were started. The stellar fires were ignited, since all of them are burning out. That "since all are burning out" is my quotation marks. Continuing his quotation. And the whole vast pageant of the universe was brought into being. Continuing the quotation. Most of the clues, moreover, that have been discovered at the inner and outer frontier of scientific cognition suggests a definite time of creation. Remember, this is not a teacher of Christian evidences at Trinity College. This is Dr. Seaborg at the University of California. He also says, the unvarying rate at which the uranium expends its nuclear energies and the absence of any process leading to its formation indicates that all the uranium on Earth must have come into existence at the same time. See why they had to go to the Big Bang? Remember, we said earlier, it's either a matter of taking in the beginning God or poof. My poof is not big enough. It's a Big Bang. That's science. Infallible science. You're supposed to give up the Bible for it. I'm not going to do it. There are several fields that we could use here. Astronomy is one of them. We've already mentioned it earlier, so I'm not going to go into it here. Let me just read this article that was in the Daily Bread. He was quoting Einstein again. It appeared in the Daily Bread. I've got the date here somewhere. I usually put it down when I cut it out because they don't put the date on it. I can't. 1955, I believe it was. It has been estimated that there are more stars than there are single grains of sand in all the beaches of the earth. You'll see an article in your notes where God likens the children of Israel someday to the stars of the heavens for multitude and the sands of the sea. And no man could have said that that was possible at all. Yet all astronomers today say that there are more bodies in the heaven than there are grains of sand in all the seashores of the earth. Albert Einstein estimated that there were 10 octillion stars. Now, of course, they haven't seen the edge. He's guessing. But from the length to which he can guess at the 200-inch telescope on Mount Palomar, 10 octillion is 1 with 27 zeros after it. Remember, it's billions, it's millions, billions, trillions, quadrillions, quintillions, septillions, octillions. It is said that Dr. Walter L. Wilson, the famed Christian physician and preacher, was once visiting an international exposition where the world's largest dictionary was on display. In his characteristic way, Wilson asked the attendant, "How many words are in that book?" Without a moment's hesitation, the man said, "About 800,000. Wilson said, "That's too bad." The man looked at him in peculiar and said, "What's the matter? Aren't 800,000 words enough for you?" Well, he said, "Yes, they're enough for me." But he said, in Psalms 147, we read that God who made the stars called them all by names. He said, "How in the world are we going to get enough names for all those stars with only 800,000 words?" And from there he started preaching the gospel to the man. Dr. Wilson was a physician that God finally led in the ministry like he did Dr. DeHaan until he didn't have time to work as a physician any longer. Wilson was a speaker all over the world. You ought to buy his books if you can get any of those. Both of them are little pamphlets, but they're wonderful. In the light of the present knowledge, though, it has been estimated that we would need over 12 sextillion dictionaries containing 800,000 words each to have enough vocabulary to name all the stars. And yet God says he named the stars, calls them all by name. You find some of them in Job. And we still follow those names for those particular ones, like Nazareth and the season and Orion. Remember what I said earlier on the same subject, when they asked Dr. Milligan, who was head of the observatory on Mount Wilson, no means astronomer, what they expected to see with the 200-inch telescope on Mount Palomar. And he said, "I don't know what we will see, but I know what we won't see." They said, "What?" "Over the edge," he said. "Well, after the rapture, I hope God lets me go and look over the edge. I'd like to go to the edge of the whole thing and shout his praise. How great thou art." That's why I love that song so much. Let me give you one nut in your notes, except for the very brief statement on page 38, top of the page. Who told Job of a hole in the north? Job 26:7. "He stretcheth out the north over the empty space." All the early telescopes couldn't discover that at all. It didn't show it. But with a 100-inch telescope on Mount Palomar, there's that hole in the north. It's a great space in which no light, from which no light emanated or no light came through. The Hebrew for that empty place is Al-Tohu. A-L, the one word, and then Tohu, T-H-O-H. You. The same word as Genesis. Without form and void. The word void. The word without form or formless. It has the idea of emptiness, deep place, abysmal place. It's the same word used in Genesis 1-2. Void. Now, that same place is called the black hole in the north. And they found more black holes, but that's one of the biggest ones that they've been just trying to work at. They can't take any pictures of it. I'll show you why. They only can use various short waves and laser beams, but they can't penetrate. I want to read some, not just the one from York, but some others here, observatory. In this black hole is a concentration of gravity, of matter and energy, which is a kind of a graveyard of burnt out, irreducible matter and energy. Einstein, in his theory of relativity, also included the theory of light and energy and matter, that energy and matter were interchangeable, and that it would collapse within itself when all of its energy came to the lowest tension, so that nothing could escape from it, but everything within its range would be drawn into it, even light. No light can penetrate it, no light can escape it. It was reported by three teams of scientists, and I cut it out of the Associated Press and the Tampa Tribune on Sunday, November the 25th, 1973. This statement, one teaspoonful of matter from the black hole would weigh more than a billion tons. Here's why no light can escape, or matter either. From the observatory of NASA, X-ray equipment from one of the satellites 400 miles from the Earth confirms what was observed from the Lick Observatory in San Jose, California. You can't take telepictures of the black hole or anything in it, since no light can penetrate or escape. Normal pulsars cannot penetrate. Only X-rays. And here's the thing I want you to see. Job said it's in the north. Underscore that. In the north. In Job 26:7. Who told Job there's a hole in the north? Let's see why the hole's there. They know that in that hole in the north in particular, in the constellation of Orion, there is a black gulfing hole, gaping hole. And it seems to be the center that's holding our whole Milky Way universe together. Everything seems to be revolving around it. 20,000 light years across. With anywhere from 1 billion to 2 billion stars in it. And all the other matter, planets. For instance, we know now that there, 11 planets around Uranus. We used to think there were only 3 that they actually pictured, but now the satellite going by it discovered more, some of them back of it. Now, Some years ago, Professor Bernard of York's observatory, and this is one in your notes, reported this black hole in the north. He said, I have discovered in the northern heavens a vast expanse without a single star in it, and no light coming through it. Who told Job? Now, the amazing thing is, this thick darkness, using the same word as in Genesis 1-2, when darkness is upon the face of the roaring deep, that word darkness. Solomon wrote in 1 Kings 8:12, the Lord said that he would dwell in the thick darkness. This same expression is used several times in the Old Testament. This thick darkness. In Psalms 75, 6 and 7, we read, for promotion cometh neither from the east, nor the west, nor the south, but God is the judge. Why did he say it didn't come from the north? We'll start from there. I want you to get this, we don't get anything else. I don't believe this is an accident. We'll start with Psalms 75, 6, and 7. I want you to see what the Bible has to say about this north and the place where God's throne is. You're dismissed.